Hello, and welcome back to Talking Talmud. I'm one of your hosts here, Dana Osban, here with my friend and chavruta, Ann Gordon. Our daf today, Masechet Eruvin, daf pei, 80. So one thing I want to mention, and there really was a lot to talk about in this daf today, is that this is actually the first time in Masechet Eruvin that we see the daf talk about an Erev Tavshilin, which I thought was very interesting. I know that we had mentioned the Erev Tavshilin at our introduction of Masechet Eruvin, but this is really the first time the daf discusses an Erev Tavshilin and its differences between some of the other type of Erevs that the Masechet deals with. Just as an observation, it's interesting to me that it's not until we get to daf pei that we see an Erev Tavshilin appear. Again, I think some of that has to do with that the Erevs that we are discussing in Masechet Eruvin are really Erevs of space, and an Erev Tavshilin is not an Erev of space. But still, it does fall under the Erev category. And again, it was interesting to me that it didn't show up until this daf.
I would suggest that it's also perhaps much less frequent, right? If Erev, I don't know about Erev Tchumen, because it's not such an issue for us nowadays, I guess. But Erev Chatzerot is an every Shabbos type of thing. And Erev Tavshilin only comes up every so whenever when Yantif and Shabbos fall out in a certain way and so on.
Right, 100%. Except that I would say for the individual person's observance, like in other words, I don't think about my Erev on Shabbos, right? The Erev Tavshilin.
Right, right.
But Erev Tavshilin is something that every individual does. So that to me is, right. You know, interesting just in terms of that. Okay, but let's go on. There's a bunch of interesting things here. So I'm going to start with an Amud Aleph. A discussion here that they get into here, and it begins as follows. Itmar, right? So they're going to go through a disagreement here of the Amoraim, right? Itmar shitufei mevaot. So this is a disagreement with making that type of shituf. Rav Amar ein tzarich lezakot, Ushmul Amar tzarich lezakot. So Rav says, you do not need to show possession or, you know, basically make an act of possession of the food that's used for the shituf mavoi. And Shmuel says you do need to, right? And then in terms of erevei tehumim, right, for the food they use to make an erev tehumim, Rav Amar tzarich lezakot, Shmuel Amar ein tzarich lezakot. So they reverse their positions. And for the erev tehumim, Rav says show possession of the actual food, and Shmuel says you do not need to. And again, right, it was that way of you sort of raise the food up, and it shows that you've taken possession of it. The Gemara continues and said Bishlama l'Shmuel, right? So this makes sense according to Shmuel. Hacha tanan v'hacha lo tanan, right? Why is that? Because here, where we're talking about a mavoi, right? We learned in the Mishnah that you actually have to give some type of, you have to show an act of a kinyan, of giving possession to it. That's straight in the Mishnah. But with the Eretz Tehumim, right, we didn't learn this, all right? V'hacha lo tanan. In that case, we didn't. Ela l'rav, my taima, right? So, sorry, let me back up. So when we're saying that we didn't learn it, meaning we didn't learn anywhere when we talked about Eretz Tehumim that you needed to show possession of it. So Shmuel's position makes a lot of sense according to the Gemara. Elul Rav my time, but Rav, how do we understand what his position is? So the Gemara goes on to explain that this really is actually a machlokas of the Tanayim, right? Tanaihi, right? This is a machlokas Tanayim to Amar Rav Yehuda, Amar Rav. Rav Yehuda says, right, and then Rav quotes him, right? Masa, and again, this is how they teach the halacha, which again gets back to, I think, and something that we, a recurrent theme in Masechet Eruvin, which is learning halacha from practice. Right.
Mm-hmm.
So Masa Bechalotosha Rabbi Yoshia. Right. So there was a story that happened involving the daughter-in-law of Rabbi Yoshia. Shehacha lebeit hamerchatz. Right. She went to the bathhouse. Okay. Which was beyond the tichum. Right. So it was far away. Bechashechala, and it started to grow dark, and it was going to get dark. In other words, Shabbat was going to start before she would be able to get back. So what happened? So her mother-in-law quickly made a Erev Tehumim for her so that she could safely, you know, or could, not safely isn't the right word, but that she could actually walk back because she was outside of the Tehum. And so her mother-in-law goes ahead and makes this Erev for her. And presumably it must have been without her knowledge, right? She's in the bathhouse. Maybe she didn't realize how late she was. And she goes ahead, the mother-in-law just makes this, you know, Erev quickly on behalf of her daughter-in-law. Uva masa livnei Rabbi Chiya va'asar. And so this story came in front of Rabbi Chiya, right, to basically ask, was this a valid thing that happened, right? Was it okay that the mother-in-law made this Eruv on behalf of her daughter-in-law, this Eruv Tehumim? And what does he say? He says, no, it wasn't okay. He ushered this and said, not only that, he ushered that she really wasn't allowed to come back. Amar lo Rabbi Yishmael, but Rabbi Yossi. So Rabbi Yishmael said in the name of Rabbi Yossi, right? Bavlai kol kacha tamachmir ve'eruvin. Right. So he says to Rabbi Chiya, he says, Babylonian. OK, he says, you're so stringent when it comes to Eruv. Right. Right. So Rabbi Yishmael basically says to Rabbi Chiya, he's like, what are you being so strict for? We know that the general principle in Eruvin is what? When you can be Mekel, you're supposed to be Mekel. So what's important here is what? That an Eruv was made. But to be so machmir that you're going to say that she wasn't allowed to come back. This isn't the way we do. This isn't the way that we do things. V'baylahu. So again, this same thing was raised or was discussed in front of some of the chachamim, right? Mishel chamuta eravala. Sorry, umishum delo zichtab la. So they want to know what was the issue here. What was Rabbi Chiya upset about that he said she wasn't? This wasn't a valid eruv. Was it because the mother-in-law established it for the daughter-in-law with her food, basically, right? And, you know, and therefore, right, velo ziktab la, right? And therefore, because the daughter-in-law didn't really have possession of the food, right? Or the daughter-in-law, the mother-in-law didn't give possession of the food for her. She just prepared the Arab. But preparing the Arab doesn't mean that the daughter-in-law actually had possession of the Arab. O dilma mishala ervala mishum tishalo midata. Or is it because she made an Eruv, right? Even if it was with the daughter-in-law's own food, but it's not a valid Eruv because the daughter-in-law didn't know. So again, so the machlokas comes down to, right? Is it that an issue that because she didn't actually confer possession of it, she didn't give possession of this, the mother-in-law, of the food to the daughter-in-law by symbolically picking it up? Or is it that the daughter-in-law had no idea that this Eruv was being made on her behalf? Amar lahen hakumi rabbanan, Rabbi Yaakov Shmei. So one of the rabbis, right, one of the chacham comes, Rabbi Yochanan, and he says the following to them. L'didi meparsha lamine de Rabbi Yochanan. So he says this was personally explained to me, basically, right? I heard this explicitly from Rabbi Yochanan. And what was it? Mishel chamota erva umishum delo ziktala, right? The issue was what? The issue was that it was that she didn't give possession, the mother-in-law, of the food to the daughter-in-law. And again, I love this language here of like that, how are they trying to learn the halacha out? It's really by like what he actually learned from another rabbi. And also the idea that this must have been a story that really sort of got around and really puzzled people. Because I think you could also see how this type of story could happen, right? You know, I get maybe it's not parallel, but I don't know if you've ever had like a Shabbos guest come to your house. I've had this happen a few times, or even for me, where I was running, somebody was running late for Shabbos, right? So I have said to someone before, like, do you want me to light the Shabbos candles for you? You'll make the bracha later, you know, but at least the candles were sort of lit for you, right? So you could see sort of a situation where somebody's unaware, they didn't get back in time, they didn't realize they were beyond the Tehum, and to be helpful, somebody goes ahead and makes an Eruv Tehumim for them. So I could see why this story would have generated a lot of discussion, especially because Rabbi Chiya said that it wasn't a valid Eruv. Amar le Rabbi.
Well, I just want to raise another question, which I don't have an answer to. Although I kind of hope that the Rishonim and Achronim, whoever discussed this, which is what we talked about yesterday, that Zakhil Adam Shalob Fanav. When we talk about Zakhil Adam Shalob Fanav, it means that you can benefit a person when they're not there. And presumably that, you know, the setting aside the food and the name, it's not quite giving it to her, that's true, but setting aside in her name for the sake of the Eruv, I would think that would be considered a zchut, and that she should be able, you know, if somebody else had been there to accept on her behalf, right? Maybe not the mother-in-law doing the setting aside, but somebody being able to accept on her behalf should have been enough,
right? So,
and I don't see that meant
right
here.
So it's interesting you bring it up. I think that concept only is brought up in terms of Eruv Chatzerot. I don't think that concept is brought up in terms of Eruv Tehumim. I could be wrong, but
that may be true. Right, but right. Then it just strengthens my question, which is I'm not contravening it, right? I'm curious why this is not part of
right,
the discussion.
Right, exactly. Right, right. Like, if that is the case, why isn't that a concept for Eruv Tehumim? For Eruv Chatzerot, we see that multiple times, right? That's actually...
And even Eruv Tavshilin.
Right, and for Eruv Tavshilin.
In modernity.
Exactly. So the Gemara goes on and says, Amar le Rabbi Zera le Rabbi Yaakov to Bat Yaakov. So Rabbi Zera says to Rabbi Yaakov, who now is identified as the daughter of Yaakov, Ki matei tatam aki vizil l'sulama ditzor ubaimine me Rav Yaakov bar Yidi. So he says to Rabbi Yaakov, he says, when you go to Eretz Yisrael, go the long route. In other words, don't go the shortest path. So you'll get to this place, sulama ditzor, the ladder of Tyre. And I want you to ask Rabbi Yaakov bar Yidi. In other words, this really was puzzling everybody what to do. Baimine, so Rabbi Yaakov goes and he asks him this, right? Mishal chamata erva umishum to lozik tala. Odilma, Mishala Erva, Umishum Delo Midata. And again, he asks the same question. What's the issue here? Why did Rabbi Chiya say that this was not okay? Is it because the mother-in-law used her own food and didn't sort of give, you know, possession of that food to the daughter-in-law? Or is it because she made an Erev for the daughter-in-law without the daughter-in-law knowing? Amarle, Mishal Chamata Evarla, Umishum Delo Ziktala. Right? So he goes to at the end, what? That no, the issue is that there was no possession taken. And again, we use this story to maintain the position of, or to explain the reasoning of Rav about why he felt that for Eruv Tehumim, right, this idea of the possession of the food, of giving, you know, a kinyan over to the other person must happen for an Eruv Tehumim. But I just thought this whole story of how in depth it goes, and it seems it's clear to everybody. There's something about it with the amount of discussion that nobody really likes. Rabbi Chiya's psak doesn't sit well with people, and they're trying to really figure out, like, why did he actually say this, and why did he actually paskin this way?
But nobody disagrees here. I found that to be really interesting.
That's also true, right? There's a lot of discussion around it. They respect it, but they're really trying to understand it.
But right, but at the end of the day, it's kind of like they're like, well, yeah, but we have to agree with this, even though they maybe don't want to. But I feel like nobody was able to come up with something that would circumvent the premise or whatever, the bottom line, that she has to be aware of it.
Yep, that's true. That's an excellent point. Yep.
You know, they say like, but they, right, like, I don't... Whatever, I don't want to get bogged down in the examples because you've just gone through them. But my point is just that, you know, I would expect that at the end of one of them, someone would have said like, okay, that'll work. And they never do. So they might not like that he thinks that she has to be there or at least aware of it. But they all agree.
Yeah. No.
I don't know. I feel like decision making, you know, court decision making is an interesting process. And this seems to kind of... Like you said, there's like kind of a reluctance and then like, okay, but we're going to go along with it because we don't have something better to tell you.
Yes, exactly. It's a great back and forth.
Yes. Okay. So now I'm going to move a little bit further down on the daf. And we have another case. Hahu Torzina Dehava Beshevuvute de Rabbi Zera. So in the neighborhood of Rabbi Zera, and we've heard about Rabbi Zera's neighborhood in the past, I believe, right? So there is a Torzina, a superintendent, right? Somebody who is a non-Jew who is somehow of the authority in the neighborhood. And what happens? Amrule Ogirlan Rishutach, right? They say to him, to this non-Jew, rent us your Rishut, rent us your domain. Lo Ogirlahu, but he did not. He did not want to rent to them. He did not do it. So then they went to Rabbi Zera and they said to him, what if we go and rent from his wife instead? Right? Literally it says, Mahu Lamegar, what if we would rent Zaramek Midibetu from his wife? Right? But the implication is, of course, without him knowing, because he's just turned them down. So The fact that the Jewish people who want to set up a Bnei Reuv are conniving to go talk to the man's wife and get her to sign on when he wouldn't is troubling in and of itself. But that does seem to be the case. So Rabbi Zera says to them, Amarhu, Hachi Amar Reish Lakish Mishmeda Gavar Rabba, Umanu Rabbi Chanina. So Rabbi Zera quotes Rabbi Chanina, he quotes Reish Lakish, who quoted Rabbi Chanina, saying as follows, Ishto shel Adam ma'arevet shelo midato. A man's wife can, in fact, be the one to initiate or authorize an Erev, whether or not her husband would know, right? That the woman's knowledge and participation in ownership of the location, whatever, is sufficient to count. He does not have to know, which, of course, is open to all kinds of discussion over what does it mean for a man and a husband and a wife to be, making decisions for each other within halacha, and when are they allowed to do that and when are they not? When do they count as one unit and when do they each need to be, participants from that, from knowledge? In this case, though, the implication is that Rabbi Zera is authorizing them to go and talk to the man's wife, again, without his knowledge, which I still find to be a little bit, I mean, partially amusing, but also partially troubling because I don't know, it doesn't sit well that they would kind of sneak around behind this Torzina from the neighborhood. At least that's my
Yeah,
sense.
I understand why you're uncomfortable with it. Like he said, no. It's a little bit like not respecting what he said, and going behind his back and trying to come up with another solution.
And also, I feel like when a kid does that, playing off parents against each other type of thing, okay, like we kind of expect that, whatever. And I'm not saying it's good behavior, but we understand why somebody's going to try to get a different answer from somebody else. But this brings us back to all the politics between Jews and non-Jews living in the same space. And here the non-Jew is over, in charge of the Jewish neighborhood. I feel like this is a bad recipe. Okay, but here we have another small bit of a comparable incident. Ho Torzina de Hava b'Shivuvuta de Reb Yehuda bar Ushaya. So again, there's a superintendent who lives in the neighborhood, this time not of Rabbi Zera, but of Rabbi Yehuda bar Ushaya. Amar lei, Ugarlan Rishut Tach. He says, they say to him, rent your Rishut to us, rent us your domain, so that we can, again, so that we can, the implication being that they can make an Erev and carry on Shabbos. Again, lo ogar lahu, he did not rent to them. Ati lakame de Rabbi Yehuda bar Ushaya. So now they come to Rabbi Yehuda bar Ushaya, Amar lei, Mahula Megar midabetu. He says to them, no, I'm sorry, they say to him, Amri Le, they say to him, Mala Megar Midabitu. Again, the same question. What's the halacha if we could go and rent from the wife? Again, without presumably, and I think pretty obviously, without his knowledge. Lo Hava Bide. He did not, this time, Rav Yehuda Bar Ushaya did not have an easy answer. He did not have an answer in his bide in his hands. Atulakame de Rav Matana. Matana. I'm not pronouncing that right, am I?
No, I think that's correct.
Somehow I veered into Ashkenazis. Atulakame de Rav Matana. They come before him. Lo have a bidet. He also doesn't have a ready answer, right? They're kind of stumped. Can you go to the man's wife when you know that he has already said no? Atulakame de Rav Yehuda. Amar lahu. And now Rav Yehuda has an answer. Hachi Amar Shmuel. He quotes Shmuel. Right, Shmuel has also appeared, before us in the pages of Erev and before now. Ishto shel Adam ma'arevet shelo midato, and he finally quotes the same thing that we've just seen above, which is that a man's wife can make the Erev without his knowledge. And it's interesting to me that here there's a greater struggle to get to this. It's the same conclusion, right? But there's a more, cautious, trepidatious approach to get there until they finally find somebody who has this answer, and then that's the answer. Except, of course, that the Gemara asks a question. Meitzvei, right? The Gemara has an objection to this from a Braita. The Braita says, "Nashim she'ervo ve'nishtatfu shelo midat baleihen." Women who, in fact, made an eruv and were participants and against or without the knowledge of their husbands, ain eruvan eruv. Their eruvim do not count as eruvs. And their cooperation, their cooperativeness, right, the merging of their alleyways do not count as a valid merging. So, of course, the question is, how can Shmuel rule against this Breita, right? He's just said, a woman who makes an Eruv without her husband's knowledge has made an Eruv. And the Breita says, no way, man, or no way, woman, really, right? And then the Gemara answers kind of very simply, lo kasha ha-da'asar, ha-da-lo-asar. It's not really a problem. It's not really a contradiction between that Breita and the statement of Shmuel. Why? Because the case of Shmuel is presumably the case where, yes, the wife makes the Eruv without her husband's knowledge, but that's not a case where that has to be a case where the husband would have prohibited, right, the asar, that he would prohibit the neighbors from carrying if he did not join their Eruv, right? So therefore, we're going to be lenient and say that if she joins their Eruv, that will then permit them to carry, and that's all, you know, for the good. And but in the case where a woman would not establish an Eruv without his knowledge, where she's not allowed, that kind of situation is where indeed he would not have prohibited his neighbors from carrying to begin with. So then what's she getting involved for, right? That's, it's messing with things in a way that is not considered acceptable, including without his knowledge. The rationale, there's a little bit, I think, counterintuitive, because you want, I kind of feel like we'd say, Kevan to Aser, that would be when he does not get in the way of their carrying, but it's the other way around, as it keeps being. Meaning this is consistent with our discussion of Erevin in terms of when a person gets in the way of other people carrying and when they do not.
Yeah, it's, you know, it's also an interesting story because we're talking about a non-Jew, right? And when they quote the Braisa that says a woman can make an error, you know, can't make an error, presumably that's a Jewish woman. So this also, like, I don't know, there's this like blurring here a little bit. Like, I just, from before, previously.
Right. I didn't understand why that wasn't the obvious answer. Lo kasha, ha, the non-Jewish wife of the
right,
of the that, supervisor.
The story.
Ha, the Jewish wife. Right.
That's
like,
the piece of
that's
the
what
story
I would have expected them
getting,
to say.
Because I guess it was one parak, two paraks ago when we had all that discussion about the fact that if you have a non-Jew in your courtyard, you can't even make the Eruv to begin with, and you have to rent from them in order to do it. It's like a totally separate sense of halacha. And so bringing in an example of like, can a Jewish woman make a Eruv and applying it now to this non-Jewish wife, I don't know, it was very interesting to me. It didn't totally make sense to me.
Right. I mean, I think the principles about men and women and marriage, I think, are interesting and worth the discussion independent of the actual case of Eruvin. Right. But when you're in the case, right, reading it off the daf as I've just done, I feel like there's something that doesn't quite make sense in terms of why it is that this would be permitted or not permitted, because the case is not fully parallel, because halacha never, I don't know, never, always, that's too big of a sentence. But right, in our general expectation, we certainly do not expect that the halacha will draw straight parallels between Jews and non-Jews, you know, in virtually anything. So I don't have an answer. I find it, the Gemara is clearly answering this case. I wonder if there might not have been a real case that was not a non-Jew.
Yeah, exactly. I don't, right. There seems to be something that's predicated on the fact, well, because the whole thing about renting only is really a case with a non-Jew. But I hear what you're saying.
Food for thought. Maybe we'll have clarity as we continue along. You know, again, we do keep coming, cycling back through comparable cases. So there is possibility that we will have more to say on this topic, even though we do not today.
Well, that's our DAF discussion for the day. Rank us, review us on all major podcasts. Thank you to Ravenit Michelle Farber for hosting us on the Hadron website. Let us know what you thought about some of the stories on this page on our Talking Talmud Facebook page. And until tomorrow, go and learn. Thank you.